Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Government is investigating Exxon and a number of advocacy groups for denying the orthodox line on climate change. The government calls this a fraud investigation. I call it an inquisition. It's one of the scariest threats to free speech I've seen in my entire career. Who am I? I'm Steve Simpson, Director of Legal Studies at the Ayn Rand Institute, filling in for Yaron Brook on today's Radical for Capitalism show. So welcome to everybody. Thanks for coming. And today we're going to look at these investigations. We're going to look at what's wrong with them legally, what's wrong with them morally, and what you can do to help protect free speech. We'll talk to several guests who are on the front lines of the legal and moral battle for freedom, freedom not just to think and speak about important issues, but freedom for companies to produce life-sustaining products like fossil fuels. Through it all, I'll provide my own views on the legal and philosophical issues informed by Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism and my own career, 20-year career as a lawyer. Before we dive into the topic, I want to remind everybody to follow ARI on Facebook and Twitter. My own Twitter handle is at @SSFreeSpeech. And, of course, you can find loads of information and commentary on our website, AynRand.org. All right, so let's dive in to this issue. As I said, the governments of it's actually AG attorneys general of about 15 states now have announced that they are launching investigations into ExxonMobil for allegedly lying about climate change. This announcement, the first announcement came from the New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. This was sometime within the last year or so. And he said that they were investigating Exxon to determine, and this is from a New York Times story on the issue, quote, whether the company lied to the public about the risks of climate change or to investors about how such risks might hurt the oil business. The inquiry will go back, quote, at least a decade, during which ExxonMobil funded outside groups that sought to, and keep in mind the following words, undermine climate science. They're being alleged or accused of undermining climate science. And by the way, we're going to talk to one of those outside groups today or somebody from one of those outside groups to get his view of this. And then the claim goes on, even as ExxonMobil's in-house scientists were outlining the potential consequences and uncertainties to company executives. So the idea here is that ExxonMobil has been lying to the public, undermining climate science, and funding outside groups to sort of toe their line to the public, all of which is somehow contributing to something bad happening. And what exactly is it that is going on? What exactly is it that is bad about this? We're going to explore during the show. But let me continue on with a little bit more background. So since the New York Attorney General announced this investigation, 15 attorneys general from 15 other states and the District of Columbia have joined the investigation. So one question comes to mind, what specifically do the AGs claim Exxon lied about? And the following is from the Competitive Enterprise Institute's website. It's in commentary from a lawyer by the name of Hans Bader, who quotes Schneiderman, Eric Schneiderman, who's the New York AG, as claiming that what Exxon did is they lied by claiming that by, quote, switching over to renewables by the end of this century would raise energy costs. So apparently Schneiderman and the other attorneys general disagree with this. They think that that switching over to so-called renewable energy would not raise energy costs, and they're calling that fraud. Another thing that they claim that ExxonMobil lied about is by essentially ruling out the possibility that governments would adapt or adopt climate policies stringent enough to force it to leave its reserves in the ground. Again, this is claimed to be a lie, and I don't think there's any question based on what I've read that ExxonMobil has actually said a lot of these things. But one of the questions we're going to explore today is, can this be fraud? And as will become clear as we go on through the show and I talk to my guests and give you my own views and really analyze this issue, I don't think statements like this can possibly be fraud. And that's very important to this debate, which will become clear as we go on. But let me continue on and give you a little bit more of the background context. Now, officials have issued subpoenas not only to Exxon for documents relating to the investigation, but to an organization called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a longtime Washington think tank that's been involved in environmental issues for decades. CEI is an organization that has advocated free markets and freedom and small government now for a very long time. I have followed this organization since I was in law school over 20 years ago. They're really a terrific organization, and yet they've now received a subpoena from, of all places, the Attorney General of the American Virgin Islands. And we'll have one of the guests on today from CEI, and we'll talk to him about the investigation and what it means to them. What I would call it, as I said before, it's an inquisition. It is a real threat to freedom of speech. And I'll get into why I think this is such a grave threat to free speech and why we really have to fight back against it as I go. A little more background. So you may recall that these investigations really come on the heels of some claims by some what I'll call climate insiders, in a sense, or climate change insiders. So about a year ago, I think, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and then later on 20 climate scientists wrote letters and made claims that the government ought to investigate the fossil fuel industry for, if you can believe it, RICO violations, right? I don't know how much people know about RICO. RICO is the racketeering-influenced corrupt organizations law. It is essentially the law that the federal government passed decades ago to fight the mafia, right? So what we have here is the government treating oil companies and a nonprofit advocacy organization as though they are a racketeering organization, as though this is a conspiracy, like a mob conspiracy, to violate the law. That alone should strike us as utterly outrageous and utterly crazy, and yet this is seriously being claimed now. So that's completely crazy. So what's going on here? Don't people have the right to decide for themselves what to believe about global warming? I mean, isn't this a debate in which everyone should be entitled to make up their own minds? To put the point succinctly, what happened to freedom of speech? Now, before I get into my own commentary, let me quote Eric Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, again on this topic, because he says something that is both interesting and important. Here's what he said. Quote, "The First Amendment, ladies and gentlemen, does not give you the right to commit fraud." Now, I'll say this much for Schneiderman. He's definitely right about that. The First Amendment doesn't give you the right to commit fraud. No right, no proper protections for a right or for freedom gives you the right to violate the law or to violate the rights of others. But here's the question. Can this be fraud? Now, let me back up a minute. A lot of people who've reacted to this issue, to these investigations, have rightly made the point that this is a serious and grave free speech issue. They're definitely right about that. There's no question that this is a grave freedom of speech issue. But the one thing that I think that at least those that I've read haven't really grappled with is the question of how do you reconcile fraud with freedom of speech? Because as I said, Schneiderman is definitely correct about that. He's definitely right that that if this is fraud, it's not freedom of speech. And you could think about it the other way. If it's free speech, properly free speech, then it can't be fraud. One way to think about this issue is that the right to free speech, and indeed any right, ends where proper criminal law begins. So the question is this: can it be fraud? What is the dividing line between freedom of speech and fraud, and how do we know the difference? Let me quote Ayn Rand on this point for a minute, or actually on a broader point. She once said that definitions are the guardians of rationality. And continuing on, the quote, the truth or falsity of all man's conclusions rest on the truth or falsity of his definitions. When I first read that as a young man, I thought, I don't really get this. I don't understand what she's talking about. Why is this? Why are definitions so important? I mean, you can look stuff up in the dictionary, you know, okay, people can debate about definitions, and but why is it such an important issue? Why is she focused so much on the idea that all of our conclusions, all of our knowledge rests on the truth or falsity of our definitions? And I would submit that this issue, what we are seeing happening to Exxon now and to CI, emphasizes and underscores her points, right? So one way to think about it is this. Criminal laws define the difference between what we are free to do and what government may forcibly prevent us from doing. If we get the criminal laws wrong, if we get the definitions of those laws wrong, we end up either, on the one hand, unleashing the power of government on innocent people by defining some things as crimes which are not crimes, or we end up unleashing criminals on innocent people by defining some things as free, which in fact should be criminalized. So the key point here is how we define fraud in this context, and more broadly, how we define our criminal laws is absolutely essential to the protection of freedom. It really goes to the central purpose of government, which is to protect our freedom. But in order to protect us from government, from the force that government possesses, remember that what government is a legal monopoly on the use and of force against people. Nobody else has the right to use force except government. The way we rein in government and prevent it from violating our rights and make sure that it protects our rights is by having very clear views of what constitutes a crime and what constitutes freedom. Of course, Ayn Rand spoke in detail, at least in the principles of this issue, and I'll get into this a little bit as the show progresses, but her answer to this, in essence, was you need to have a proper conception of rights, because rights defines the difference between what we may do and what we may not do. And her essential point on this was the only way that you can violate rights is through the initiation of force, using force against other people. So part of what we have to figure out in analyzing this Exxon issue is, did Exxon, in allegedly committing fraud, did it do something that amounts to the initiation of force? One way you can think about the issue of fraud is it's kind of like theft. It's I would call it theft by trickery, theft by fooling a person. Now, I'm going to get in a little bit later on in the show into more details about how we define fraud and dig down just a little bit into the elements of fraud, because I think it's really important for people to understand, because it bears on just what is wrong with these prosecutions. They really get the issue of fraud wrong. They characterize things that are properly and legitimately considered a debate as fraud, and that's what I want to dig down into. But before getting into that, let me turn to our first guest, who is calling in right now. Sam, can you hear me? Hi. Okay, let me introduce you first before we get into discussing this really important issue. This is Sam Kasman. Sam is the general counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's been with the organization since the 1980s. Sam, earlier before you came on the line, I was telling our guests that I've been a fan of CEI since before I went to law school over 20 years ago. I think you guys are one of the terrific groups in Washington, D.C., doing many great things out there, and welcome to the show, and I want to congratulate you on the stance you're taking against the government in these investigations.
Thank you. I thought you were about to congratulate us on getting served with a subpoena, but in a way, they're not that different.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's true, and that's really what I want to talk about. So let's get into that. You've been served with a subpoena. The subpoena seeks information in connection with Exxon, I guess it is, and the oil company's funding of your activities. But why don't you tell our guests a little bit about that subpoena, and then we can talk a bit more about it in detail.
Sure. This is something we received back on April 7th. And until then, we'd been following the various calls coming from certain environmentalists, from global warming alarmists, for some sort of investigations under RICO, either by the Department of Justice or elsewhere, of what they term global warming deniers and skeptics. Then there was this press conference that seven attorneys general held up in New York at the very end of March. And that had as its star guest Al Gore. So I think that's some indication of how a seriously intellectual effort this is on their part. And so nonetheless, we were still surprised to get served with a subpoena. This was focused on ExxonMobil, but which in our view has taken, you know, a totally legitimate stance on global warming, at least they used to. And we were surprised that they were going after think tanks, nonprofits, possibly individuals who held similar views as well.
So, you know, when you read up on this issue, and I think I probably pay too much attention to what lawyers think. I'm a lawyer myself, but I've read people who wonder, okay, so what's the big deal here? It's just a subpoena. It's just asking for information. I mean, it's not like anybody has accused you guys of a crime. Now, I know just what it means to get a subpoena like what CEI has received, but I want you to, if you can, give our listeners a sense of why is this such a threat to CEI's free speech?
Sure. First of all, there's the scope of the subpoena, which at first glance seems to be just focused on our dealings with ExxonMobil. But if you read it carefully, it really covers just about everything we've done in on climate and energy policy for one full decade, a decade that ended at the end of 2006. And secondly, quite a bit of it would also cover communications we've had with our supporters and donors. And once we start risking the threat of our donors' identities being revealed, that leaves them open to intimidation. So we see this really as not just a huge burden for us to comply with, but something really aimed at chilling both our speech on this issue and, just as importantly, chilling the right of our donors to remain confidential when they've supported our work. Now, you know, I've mentioned ExxonMobil, but ExxonMobil was a publicly identified donor to CEI for a number of years before 2006, and that is, it's something that they stated publicly in their foundation reports and so forth. But we do not disclose the identities of our donors unless they wish to be disclosed. And frankly, there's a long line of Supreme Court cases upholding that confidentiality under the First Amendment. The very first case in that line was in the late 1950s when the NAACP was sued by the state of Alabama, which itself wanted to get hold of a list of their donors, and it was clear the sole reason that the state wanted to do that was to shut the NAACP down.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the NAACP case. I spent over a decade at the Institute for Justice litigating campaign finance cases, and we, of course, relied on that case all the time. And it's crystal clear that the government can use disclosure of donors and supporters as an intimidation tactic. I mean, it obviously happened back in the 1950s, but we've seen it happen in recent decades with respect to campaign disclosures. It's clearly there's a kind of outing or chilling effort that we often see people using disclosure laws. And so I'm right there with you. And it strikes me that it's just obvious that that's what they're trying to do. But let me ask the question, why are they singling out CEI? I don't think they've gone after any other think tanks yet, although correct me if I'm wrong. But what do you think is going on here? Why are they going after you guys first?
Well, I like to think it's because of the effectiveness of our work on climate and energy policy. Al Gore himself a few years back actually commented saying that CEI has been tremendously effective in its work, but he was not complimenting us. He was lamenting that. Nonetheless, it's a quote that we did happily publicize. So that is one possibility. Another is that a number of analysts here had blog posts and columns criticizing the whole general attempt by the New York State Attorney General Schneiderman to go after ExxonMobil under his state law, which is something that started before this campaign kicked off. So, you know, it's possible there is one element of retribution there as well.
The other thing that's interesting about this is that the subpoena comes from the AG of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Do you have any thoughts on why they're in on this and why you guys have been subpoenaed by them?
No, I do know that the Virgin Islands AG was at the New York City press conference sharing the stage with Schneiderman as well. And it's possible he had some sort of open investigation into Exxon before this started. But there are several ironies here that it does come from the Virgin Islands. For one, it was only a few months ago that the same attorney general had gone after the Hess Oil Company, not in an attempt to shut them down, but really in an attempt to keep a refinery plant open in the Virgin Islands. He believed that Hess's closure of that refinery violated some tax credit agreements that had been involved in setting that refinery up in the first place. So on the one hand, he had gone after Hess for shutting down a refinery. On the other hand, here he himself sort of wants to shut down ExxonMobil. That's one point I'd make. Secondly, the degree of hypocrisy involved in his going after fossil fuels generally is really amazing, because think how this guy gets to other countries, how he gets to the U.S. Unless he either swims or rows a boat or sails a boat, he is relying on transportation that uses energy from fossil fuels. And that's really what all these folks do. They jet around the country, around the world. They get driven to their podiums at one event after another. And the first thing they do is to condemn the very sorts of energy that make their political life possible.
Yeah, it's. Heck, I would even go beyond that. I would say their lives. It makes their lives possible, and it really is outrageous. And that's one of the things we're going to be exploring in the show a little later on. But I'm glad you raised that point. The hypocrisy is really just outrageous. But let me turn then. Do you have views on the legal theories? I mean, I have to say, you know, I'm not an expert in fraud law, but I'm a lawyer and intelligent enough to think this through. And it strikes me that this sort of thing just can't be fraud based on the nature of the type of debate we're having, the open-ended nature of it, the fact that there's so much uncertainty on this issue of climate change, that the very idea that a debate about this could be turned into fraud strikes me as outrageous. But I'd love to get your views on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think the use of fraud to characterize the supposedly bad behavior of the folks involved in discussing their skeptical views of climate alarmism, using fraud is a way to shut down the debate from the back end. There is no fraud here. If you think that I suspect that the only sorts of, you know, alleged smoking gun documents that anyone has dug up on Exxon is that maybe some of their scientists had different views on global warming risks than other of their scientists. But do you find the, you know, scientists on the alarmist side of this debate admitting that back in the 90s, for example, there simply was not enough data to conclude that man was responsible for the alleged warming? And since then, you've had a nearly 20-year plateau in global temperatures, which runs directly contrary to what the climate models were predicting. You know, the Virgin Islands claims that because they are islands, this is the words of their AG, they're peculiarly susceptible to the ravages of bad weather and rising ocean levels supposedly caused by global warming. It was only a few weeks ago that Warren Buffett informed his massive number of shareholders that his reinsurance company had not experienced any increase in either the cost or frequency of severe weather events like hurricanes. So if you've got this businessman who's got, you know, decades of experience in the reinsurance industry saying that, hey, they are not seeing any cost effects of global warming as far as weather goes, you know, the notion that this is a closed debate is pure garbage, really.
Yeah. No, that's
actually
a really,
you know,
good point. Go ahead.
I'd just like to mention, I recently ran across this quote by a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, Ivar Gaver, who used to be an Obama supporter, but he recently stated, quote, "Global warming really has become a new religion because you cannot discuss it. It is like the Catholic Church." You know, so I've heard some people say, look, you guys, in comparing this investigation to the Inquisition, are over the top. When you've got a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, especially one who used to support Obama, the notion that this is hyperbole is crazy. You know, I think he's dead on, and that's yet another indicator of how wide open this debate still is.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think your use of the word Inquisition is exactly right. You know, one of the things I was thinking as you were talking is that one would think a guy like Paul Ehrlich would be a little bit nervous about these cases, given that he's been making predictions for, what, five decades, all of which that have turned out wrong. And indeed, the environmentalist movement in general has been making wild predictions. They constantly turn out wrong. I mean, don't they get the fact that if they can sue oil companies or if they can go after advocacy groups, the same thing can happen in reverse?
You know, they may regard that as a theoretical threat, but I think they've got this deep conviction that there will always be a friendly administration in power and there will always be a political culture whose winds blow in their favor. But you do have a lot of people on the left. You do have a lot of moderate liberals and I'd say leftists who do see this as a threat to freedom of speech, regardless of what your position is on global warming.
Yeah, that's good to know. We got just a couple more minutes. I want to close by just mentioning to listeners that you guys have now responded to this subpoena, and I got to say, in really forceful terms, so you and your lawyers are to be congratulated. Let me just read one line from the letter written to the AG that sent you this subpoena. Quote, "Your demand on CEI is offensive, it is un-American, it is unlawful, and it will not stand." I have to tell you, as a lawyer, you don't see that kind of thing very often. You know that, I know that, but I don't think the folks listening in know that this is not the kind of letter you typically hear from lawyers. They're a lot more muted. But I want you to just we'll close by talking about, I mean, you guys have taken a real strong, what I would call, moral stance. I admire you for it, and I congratulate you for it. But speak a little bit in closing about the importance of, you know, taking the kind of stance that you're taking.
Look, I think it's important from at least two viewpoints. One, the whole free speech issue obviously is at the core of Western democracy. But secondly, in terms of the whole global warming debate, I think this really is an attempt to demonize energy. And once you've got energy demonized, I believe you have civilization by the throat.
That is a really good way to put it, and a great way to end. Sam, let me thank you again, not just for being on the show, but you guys are real heroes. You're fighting a battle that needs to be fought exactly the way you're fighting it. So thanks very much for everything you guys are doing.
Okay, thank you and your listeners for both their support. And if they want to go to our website, make a contribution, that's always welcome.
Yeah, and I'll encourage people to do that. So thanks.
Take care. Bye.
All right, so I think what now we're going to do now is go to a short break, and then I'll be back to discuss a little bit more about what Sam and I just talked about and some of the implications of this case.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Okay, we're back talking about the Attorney's General investigations of Exxon and of CEI, the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I just had Sam Kasman, who's the General Counsel at CEI, on as a guest. Sam made a lot of really good points about this issue, and in particular, the threat not only to free speech, but as he put it toward the end of our discussions, if they can go after energy, if they can go after fossil fuels, they can really go after Western civilization. And I mean, I can't think of a better way of putting that. We'll talk to some other guests that will elaborate on those points a little bit later. But I want to echo one thing that Sam said that I think is really important. He said that that there's a physicist out there. I forget the name of the guy that he mentioned, but he's a physicist out there who started off as, I'll use the term warmist, you know, much more sympathetic to the idea of the climate change crowd and the people who are complaining about it's not just complaining that the earth might warm, but it's complaining that it's a catastrophe and will somehow ruin our way of life. And he's likened this argument, this attitude, to a religion. Sam used the term Inquisition. Of course, I've titled the show The Climate Change Inquisition for a reason. And I don't think that that's just hyperbole. That's not just a figurative way of discussing what this represents for freedom of speech and intellectual freedom and the approach that environmentalists are taking on this issue. It very much is like a religion. It parallels it in many ways, and I want to talk about that in a minute. Let me say, though, that I do think that there are certainly legitimate scientific questions here. My point here is not everything that environmentalists say is completely wrong, or anybody that believes that we might be warming the globe is completely wrong. My point here is that we need to think that through. Importantly, we need to take a moral perspective on that, which means we need to think about this as it relates to human beings. We need to think about what the impacts on human beings are of global warming, and very importantly, of what it is that we seek to give up, or what it is they're claiming we want to give up. I mean, fossil fuels are an absolute boon to humanity. I mean, they have, along with, I mean, in one way you might think about it is that fossil fuels, in a sense, spurred the Industrial Revolution. If it weren't for energy, the Industrial Revolution could not have happened. The Industrial Revolution is the single most important event in all of world history, in my view. It's when the world went from squalor, disease, absolute, not just unhappiness, but no possibility really of most people to pursue their own happiness. And then we went from that feudalism and the divine right of kings into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. And we got the Industrial Revolution, which was the flowering of production and wealth. It led to, I think, within a few hundred years, quadrupling of the world population. We have more people today. All of the by every indication, life is getting better and better under capitalism. So the idea that we should somehow shut off the engine of the Industrial Revolution by going after fossil fuels and adopting energy policies that pale in comparison is absolutely ridiculous. So I think using the idea that that people represent something very akin to the religious mentality that prevailed during the Dark Ages is exactly right. Let me make a point about that in the context of free speech, because we need to think about when we think about free speech, we need to think about the value of free speech and what it really means to human beings and just how important it is. I often think of it as you can't think of freedom of speech without thinking of freedom of thought and intellectual freedom in general. So we should step back for a minute and think that through. So one way that people often describe freedom of speech and the value of it is something like the following. Well, everybody is entitled to their own opinion. Yes, okay, that's true. We're all entitled to our own opinion. But there's much more to free speech, and the underlying essence of free speech, which is intellectual freedom and the freedom of thought, than just having your own opinion. The way I would put it is this: freedom of thought, using reason, is our basic tool of survival, right? If we don't have the freedom to think, we don't have the freedom to pursue knowledge, we don't have the freedom to arrive at truth, we don't have the freedom to create the kinds of things that we've created, that mankind has created, throughout all of world history, but certainly since the Industrial Revolution. One of my favorite writers on this topic has talked about or called free speech the killer app of civilization. And what he means by that is that without freedom of speech, you don't have a modern world. I mean, and I mean that literally. If you don't have free speech, you cannot have the modern world. Why? Because we can't transmit and communicate information to one another. We can't accumulate knowledge. Think about the division of labor that we have in modern capitalism. That wouldn't be possible without free speech, because people wouldn't be able to communicate their ideas. They wouldn't be able to organize their affairs the way they do today. So an attack on free speech is an attack on Western civilization. It is just as grave as what Sam talked about. So we really need to fight back. But I want to dig a little bit deeper for the next couple minutes, and then we'll get to our next guest. think about it like this. I mean, in order to conduct your life, you need to think and you need to arrive at conclusions. The only way you can do that is by self-actualization, by self-generated thought. You have to choose to focus. You have to choose to activate your consciousness. You have to choose to think. It can't be forced. Imagine what it means, or think about what it means for somebody to try to force you to believe something. And let's take this issue of climate change. So I've been studying this issue on and off over the last 20 years at least. And I have to say, I can't make up my mind on exactly what's happening now. Obviously, I'm not a scientist, but I am an intelligent guy who can read. And trying to get to the bottom of this issue is damnably difficult. So I mean, in general, I take a moral perspective on it. I think that what we need to do is think about it from the standpoint of human life, and that fossil fuels and industrialization are absolutely essential. But I can see that maybe there is some issue that we would want to think about, if the planet is going to get warm, or any environmental issue or any scientific issue. Yet I haven't made up my mind about that. So what does it mean when somebody comes and threatens me with a lawsuit, which is essentially what this is all about? It's not just Exxon, it's not just CEI that's being threatened, it's not just advocacy groups, it's everybody who wants to think independently about this issue. What does it mean when somebody comes to you and they say, believe my view or else? What they are essentially saying is, abandon your own mind, abandon your own thoughts, abandon everything that you have thought about this issue, forget all that you've learned, forget all of the books that you've read, forget all of the grappling that you have done to try to understand and grasp this issue. Shut up, turn your mind off, and follow us, right? Just follow what we say. We are now in control of what you think. What does that conjure up in your mind? What it conjures up in my mind is the idea of blind faith, right? That is what religions ask people, ask of their followers. Follow us blindly. Give up your mind. That's what faith is. Faith is the opposite of reason. And I mean, you can find many, many religious people throughout history saying exactly that. So this is not a controversial point. This is not a point that is debatable. That is what the idea of faith is. It's follow your feelings. It's follow religious commandments. It's follow what the priests or the imams or whomever tell you to follow. It's turn your mind off and just follow us blindly. What that is tantamount to saying is, what you think doesn't matter. And of course, if what you think doesn't matter and we're calling for your blind adherence to our views, it makes perfectly good sense to force you to do what we want you to do, right? If you're turning your mind off and you're just going to blindly follow us, of course we can push you around. You're essentially like a slave or a farm animal that can be whipped into shape and whipped to toe the line. So that's ultimately what is at the root of these investigations, and I think more broadly is at the root of the environmentalist movement and the debate about climate change. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't think there are legitimate scientific issues to resolve. What it does mean is that without absolute freedom, without being free of any intimidation, of any harassment, and certainly of a threat of a lawsuit by the government or threat of force by the government, nobody can resolve this issue. And when you run up against people who are claiming that you should just shut up and follow them blindly, you are essentially running up against what amounts to a religious mentality. It is people who don't care about what you think and they just want to order you around. That's the hallmark not of a nation like the United States of America. That is the hallmark of things like the Spanish Inquisition, the rigid orthodoxy that was enforced during the Middle Ages. It's the hallmark of communist countries. It's the hallmark of fascist countries. It's the hallmark of every collectivist and statist dictatorship that's ever existed. If you examine those countries, what they say is follow the leader blindly and without thought. We will stamp out all individual thought and we will force you to do what we want. So if we accept the basic premise of these attacks on Exxon and on CEI and indeed on the entire fossil fuel industry, what they have now become, I think they've revealed themselves for what they always wanted to be, which was an effort to control what other people think and do and ultimately put capitalism in a country like America under their thumbs. If we take that seriously at its core, at its principle, it doesn't mean every single environmentalist agrees with this, but it does mean that the essence of this movement and the essence of what the movement is all about is about forcing people and intimidating people into towing a line, into following an orthodoxy, which is tantamount to blind faith. All right, our next guest now, I think, will be able to speak eloquently to that issue, so let's get him on here. Alex, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Alex. Okay, so let me introduce you. Alex Epstein, I think many of our listeners will be familiar with Alex. He is the head of the Center for Industrial Progress, the author of a really great book called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, which, by the way, if you haven't read that book, now would be a really good time. I think Alex has, excuse me, one of the coolest jobs I can imagine. He gets to go around and fight for the morality of industry and fossil fuels. He was in Congress testifying a couple weeks ago. He did an awesome job of that. You should really watch that YouTube video. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. Good to be here.
So we're obviously, I think, as you know, talking about these investigations of Exxon and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And I was just talking about how what I think the essence of the view is behind these investigations and the threat of lawsuits is tantamount to kind of a religious worldview. You know, they're trying to force people to toe the line and calling kind of for blind faith. But I wonder if you'd give us a bit of your own view on that, not just on these lawsuits, but the broader context of this issue in general.
Okay, well, I should say I didn't hear exactly what you said. So if we disagree, then it'd be interesting to hear what the
no problem at all
is. But I think it should just be of great concern to somebody to just hear on the face of it that some group of people, whether it's a group of attorney generals or congressmen, are going after a company for what they say publicly or for what they don't say publicly. Because it should be pretty clear that this has something to do with the right to freedom of speech. So what's going on in particular in this case is really what they're saying is Exxon and then others, but you know, Exxon did not publicly say that we're facing a climate catastrophe, and then they claim to have research inside Exxon that shows Exxon knew. You know, Exxon knew there was a climate catastrophe, and they didn't say anything about it. There are so many things wrong with this that it's hard to know where to start, because you can just, well, for instance, pick on the fact that there has been no climate catastrophe. The catastrophists have been proved wrong. They keep extending the due date of their, you know, predictions because they keep getting it wrong. But nevertheless, had Exxon publicized this, it would have been publicizing a wrong view and done the public a disservice. But you know, the real question is, under what circumstances is it legitimate for government to be involved in terms of a company's viewpoints?
Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly, but let's unpack a few of those things. And let me step – I'd like to have you sort of step back. I mean, to say that people have been dropping the context of the debate over climate change and we could broaden it to more environmental issues, I think, is a vast, vast understatement. And one of the things you do in your book is establish that context, how we need to think about this issue, which makes it, frankly, the most invaluable thing I think that I've read on the issue. But if you would give our listeners a sense of that context, what should people think about, not necessarily in the context of these investigations, although it definitely bears on that, but when we're analyzing this issue of climate change, how do we need to think about that issue?
Well, you know, an analogy I like to use is vaccines. So let's say that somebody says vaccines can have side effects, which is certainly true. And so then they you say, well, I choose to vaccinate my kids. And then they say, well, you must be a vaccine side effect denier, right? Because vaccines have side effects and you're using vaccines and therefore – But you say, wait a second, no, what I'm doing is I'm saying, no, I consider this product a net good. You know, I consider the benefit to far, far outweigh the risk. And so, you know, when we use fossil fuels, we're doing the same thing. we're saying that we're using it because it's this amazing industry, really, that produces cheap, plentiful, reliable energy on a scale and with a variety of use cases that no other industry can come close to. And in the sense of, you know, individual users, they figured out how to make it very safe. And then there are these issues, more aggregate issues, so issues of people, you know, that involve multiple people simultaneously, like pollution and, of course, the climate issue. And there you do have to look at sort of aggregate types of harms because you're dealing with aggregate types of actions. But then, you know, my contention is if you look at those, you have to look at them very carefully in the context of the benefits, in the same way that if you went back to the time when they were pioneering fire, you wouldn't say, oh, well, believe, you know, you're a smoke denier because, you know, you want to use fire and yet it has smoke and, you know, the smoke has some effects. But the point is, no, the fire is unbelievably valuable. And so what's not happening at all in this debate is people considering the big picture, people looking at objectively and carefully what are the actual positives and negatives, and there's a lot to doing that carefully. So with the, you know, the realm of climate, you have to look at, for example, what is demonstrated about climate and what is speculated. And then if you're looking at the impact of fossil fuels on climate, it makes a big difference what the magnitude is. Are you dealing with mild warming or are you dealing with a runaway warming? And then at the same time, you can't just look for negatives or assume things are negatives. You have to be open to the possibility that warming might be better for human beings, that there's no particular temperature that's the perfect temperature or average temperature. There's no particular amount of CO2 that's the perfect amount of CO2. And you should be open to things such as, well, more CO2 might create more greening, which I think it certainly does. And above all, I think the issue that's most neglected with climate, besides just factoring in all the incredible, irreplaceable benefits of fossil fuels, even if there were a negative climate thing, the number one thing that's overlooked in climate is that our climate has gotten far safer as we use more fossil fuels. And the reason is that fossil fuels only have a very mild warming effect, but they have a huge protective effect because the number one cause of climate safety or danger is the presence or lack of development and infrastructure and everything that keeps you safe. And that's what a high energy civilization enables you to do. So I like to say nature doesn't give us a safe climate we make dangerous. It gives us a dangerous climate we need to make safe. And you absolutely need a lot of energy to do that. So even climate turns out to be a huge net benefit for fossil fuels. But even if it were a negative, you would have to look at it in the context of this is a technology that extends people's lives by 10, 20, 30 years. So the idea that you would only focus on, in effect, the vaccine side effect and not on the vaccine, that's what's going on in the fossil fuel debate methodologically.
Yeah, I mean, those are all really, really good points. And as I'm sure you're aware, I mean, Exxon is being accused of fraud. Fraud, just very briefly, essentially, you can think of it as, you know, you're stealing something from somebody by lying to them. And so lying to people is relevant here. And then one of the things that they'd have to show is that there's actually been a damage. But if you wanted to accurately assess what the so-called damages of the lying, supposedly lying, I mean, I think both of those things are bogus claims. But part of what you're saying here is that we would need to think about other, you know, the both the costs and the benefits. So if somebody were to say, you know, try to assess the costs versus the benefits of the oil industry, what would your response be?
Well, I mean, the part of the context is, you know, it should always be within the context of a rights-respecting society. So there's such a thing as, you know, a company spills oil on somebody's land and that's a damage, and you can add that to the aggregate, and in some ways that's worth doing. But the main thing is, well, that's an abuse of the technology and that should be forbidden by the law.
Right.
But if you were to just to get a big picture sense of what's going on, I mean, the benefits of oil versus the cost, I laugh because it's like saying what's the benefit of food versus the cost. I mean, and, you know,
right.
One major use case of and, you know, actually food is more dangerous than oil. And I mean that very seriously. Like, you're more likely to get sick from food than you are from oil. I mean, oil is machine food. And, you know, the core difference physically between our standard of living and the standard of living most people had throughout history is living in a machine labor civilization versus a manual labor civilization. And oil provides us, you know, the single most versatile form of energy ever devised, particularly for portable applications where you need to carry your fuel with you. So there are reasons why all the airplanes are running on oil, you know, oil-based fuel, like kerosene, jet fuel, stuff like that. There's a reason why they're not running on solar panels. And I think the solar plane that went up a year or two ago had, you know, one person could fit in, and then there wasn't as much sun as they expected, so it had to be grounded. I mean, think about how primitive that is compared to, you know, just a modern plane that can hold hundreds of people. So it's just such an amazing, wonderful thing. So anything that's connected to mobility is going to be connected to oil. And perhaps the most vivid is just food. I mean, food is we've hugely eliminated the problem of drought in the world as a cause of death almost completely in the U.S., you know, for a number of reasons. One is we can just produce a lot more. We have mechanized agriculture. We have fertilizer derived from natural gas, which is, you know, which goes along with oil in terms of production. But also, I think unappreciated is the mobility or the of food in terms of transport. So if you can transport things very rapidly, what that means is you have new farms that can go online because they can produce a lot and then their product can be moved. Whereas if they're fairly isolated and it's too costly to transport, it doesn't work. And then we can also transport for drought relief. So just in the example of food, you know, oil is saving who knows how many people from starvation. It might even be billions. So the idea that we have this technology that's basically solved world hunger, this industry that's solving world hunger, and it not only doesn't get credit, but it's the easiest way to be fake virtuous is to denounce the people who make it. It's really that. I mean, I was testifying in Congress last week, and I'll say 97 because what I call the climate Scientologists always like to use 97%, you know, agree. Therefore, we don't have to prove anything or explain anything. But Barbara Boxer and I had a little tangle in the Senate, and I believe she was sitting first class on my plane. I'm quite sure it was her.
But, so,
you know,
that's
four
awesome.
Times the CO2 emissions, but you see, like, this 75-year-old woman is, you know, she can travel 3,000 miles in 5 hours, and she does, to say the least, she doesn't appreciate it when she's trying to destroy the companies, and it's considered virtuous. And that's why I thought it was so important to write a book about the positive morality of fossil fuels, and not to just say, oh, we need them for a little while longer, they're not as bad as you think. But no, this is a life-enhancing product, and if people are interested, check out Moral Case for Drought on that website. And you can also see all the data for free on that website. That's moralcaseforfossilfuels.com. And I think you'll see it's just everything you've been taught is just the opposite of the truth. It turns out to be, if you think about it carefully and from the perspective of what's best for humans.
That's great. And I'm glad you mentioned the book. It really is a terrific book. Let me, I have just one or two more minutes here, if you can spare the time.
Sure.
I just want to ask you to close on, I mean, you mentioned your Senate testimony. As I said earlier, it's really an amazing and just great example of what moral courage can do. So, I mean, this is what you do for a living. You go around, you try to bolster people's moral courage, if I can put it that way. I mean, it's much more than that, obviously. But give us a sense of, I mean, I'd like you to tell our listeners just how important it is to make a moral argument and to really try to bolster people's moral courage. And what, you know, how have you seen your impact? I think you've had an impact on the way people debate this and certainly on the confidence of the industry. But give us, in closing, just a sense of your experience and how important it is to take a moral stance.
Well, I mean, every issue is a moral issue, ultimately. I mean, we're always making decisions about right and wrong, and right and wrong in relation to some goal or standard. And for me, the standard is human well-being, ultimately the well-being of the individual. And so, you know, with any issue that's important, you need to be able to connect it to morality to show that, look, this is consistent with your values and the opposite is very inconsistent with your values. And in this case, you have just a culture-wide assault on the moral goodness of this product and this industry. So I think, in terms of – so that's why it's important. And then I think the number one key is clarity. Clarity is really underrated. I mean, I am obsessive just about being clear on issues myself. And I see my job as most importantly trying to empower others by giving them a really profound state of clarity. And so the book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, is a way of doing that. There's also, if you're really interested in communication, check out the website energychampion.net. There's a course called How to Talk to Anyone About Energy. There's a preview in that if you like the course, you can buy it for a fairly low price. But check out that video, and you'll see that there's a certain methodology that I use with structuring conversations to make issues clearer for other people. And I think you get that internal clarity, and then you learn how to give external clarity, and then what you do then is you give empowerment. So you give empowerment to yourself, and then you give the seeds of empowerment to somebody else. So I really see myself as I'm creating resources that you, the listener, can use to become far more powerful than maybe you ever thought. But I can promise you it's possible to persuade almost anyone. And I've had a lot of impact on the fossil fuel industry, which people think is easy, but nobody else had really done it until I did. But it's that obsession with moral clarity, and then also the obsession with how to communicate it to someone else.
Well, great. And you're doing a great job, and I really appreciate you being on the show and continuing to fight the good fight. So thanks very much for being here, Alex.
All right. My pleasure, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
All right, so I think we're going to take another quick break, and I'll be back after that to put a number of things that we've heard from both Sam and Alex into the context of analyzing a little bit deeper why this issue can't be fraud. I really think that's an important issue that a lot of people are not focusing on for the reasons that I said earlier. The crime of fraud really defines the difference between what we are allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say. So it's really crucial to understand just how baseless and wrong that is. But first, we'll take a break, and we'll be back in a minute.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
How does economic inequality emerge in a free society? From a bunch of win-win transactions. When J.K. Rowling wrote her Harry Potter books, she created something of value. Seven great stories for which millions of people willingly and happily paid $10 or even $20 apiece. Now, what happened to inequality as a result? It grew. Rowling became a billionaire, starting from poverty, while her fans saw their income stay the same and their wealth go down by a tiny amount, that same $10 or $20 per book. Income inequality grew, but everyone was better off as a result. Everyone won through these win-win exchanges. That's the way inequality arises under freedom, and that's why it should. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
Okay, we're back. This is Radical for Capitalism. I'm filling in for Yaron Brook on the show today. My name is Steve Simpson, and I'm the Director of Legal Studies at the Ayn Rand Institute. We have been talking about the investigations launched by 15 state attorneys general against Exxon and against the Center for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank. They've been subpoenaed. We've talked to Sam Kasman at CEI. We talked to Alex Epstein, who fights for lodges or makes a moral defense of fossil fuels. I want to continue on with the analysis of both the legal claims here and the First Amendment implications. Before the break, I said that I was going to get into a little bit more about why this can't be fraud, just to remind you why spend so much time talking about what many people might think as an arcane legal issue when we should be talking about free speech. And my response is we are talking about free speech. I said earlier that properly defined crimes, or you could call them civil wrongs if in the case of torts, which is personal injuries, they define the difference between freedom, what we're free to do and what we're not free to do. And one of the things that the government in general and the AGs have capitalized on is a real lessening or destruction of the idea of what fraud properly is, a dilution of that idea, so that we've gone, I think, over the last century or so, and this has happened throughout the law, from clear definitions of what crimes are defined in terms of rights and of ultimately the initiation of force, to things that people generally find to be unethical or bad or mean or unpleasant or in some way confusing, none of which is fraud. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we progress in the next segment. Before I get to that, though, I want to raise two other issues that are floating around this question of the investigations of Exxon by the government. Alex Epstein just spoke very eloquently in favor of the fossil fuels industry. Sam Kasman spoke about how the attack on energy is ultimately an attack on Western civilization. Both of them pointed out the hypocrisy of government officials criticizing fossil fuels and petroleum and then flying first class on airlines across the country. I mean, we see this all over the place, but there's a lot more to examine in this issue than just that sort of hypocrisy. So I've asked the question, what is the line between free speech and fraud, and talked a little bit about that. Now I want to analyze two other issues. One is this notion that Exxon and the groups it has funded are actually being accused of, and this is a quote right out of the New York Times, which is quoting the AGs, of, quote, suppressing climate science. And understand that the argument here is industry groups fund research into policy issues, and whether it's climate change or anything else, and through funding that research, somehow they are suppressing climate science, which, I mean, I find that, you know, there's a lot in this show that we've been talking about that is so much it's so outrageous, it's almost too much to even find the words to describe it. Alex earlier talked about the importance of fossil fuels and the costs and benefits, and asking that question as rather like asking what are the costs and benefits of food, right? If you put it like that, nobody would really even ask that question, although maybe today they would. But I think that this idea that any private company is suppressing climate science by funding science or funding even advocacy, heck, even funding lies that disagree and go against that is not suppressing climate science. Keep in mind that these are private companies. They're not the same thing as government, right? They don't have the power to force people to buy their products. There's no way they can suppress climate science. That's tantamount to accusing them of censoring proper climate science or discussion on this issue. And it's just not possible. It is not possible for a private company to censor unless somehow they have been granted the power that the government has, which is to use force against people through the force of law. So the way to put the point positively is only government can suppress speech. Only government can censor. It's not possible for private entities to do that. And one of the things we see wrapped up in this, which Ayn Rand talked about years and years ago, decades ago, is the destruction and the corruption of our concepts. And a concept like censorship, the idea that we use the concept of censorship or suppression of speech to apply to what private entities do is utterly outrageous. And it has the opposite effect. Ultimately, if we accept this idea that private entities can suppress speech, the natural response to that would be to have government investigate them. So understand the connection there, the connection between a proper understanding of the concepts that we're using, like concepts like fraud, concepts like censorship, and the truly evil circumstance that we're seeing here with the AGs investigating and accusing Exxon of fraud. There's a logic to it. If you really believe that a private company can censor speech or suppress speech, it's natural for the government to go after them. So that's one thing we need to think about and really challenge. It's a crazy notion. It is not possible. We see it all over the place today. As a campaign finance lawyer, I have seen it for years. The idea that if you spend money on political speech, you're suppressing voters' voices and you're somehow buying the election. It's completely crazy. Next thing I want to focus on just for a moment before we get our next guest on here is the question, when we're talking about funding, what about the government, right? So there's all of this complaint about Exxon and oil companies funding climate science, but the government has been funding climate science for decades. Why isn't anybody asking questions about the impact of government funding, right? If there's a problem with the funding of climate science or of any science, it's the problem that is coming from government. Now, I want to speak a moment about that because it's a really important issue to grasp. Ayn Rand addressed the threat of government funding of science and really of intellectual endeavors at all in an essay she wrote, I think it's probably 40 years ago now, called The Establishing of an Establishment. And there she was talking about the funding of psychological research. And she calls it just as much of a threat to intellectual freedom as censorship. Now, the reason for that is that there is really no way. I mean, there are really two reasons for this. First, this money is funded through force, right? It's taken from taxpayers, and then it is given to whomever the government officials want to give that money to. Her use of an establishment is entirely appropriate. That's what it leads to. And the reason it leads to is this, an establishment is this. How are government officials who know nothing about the science here, who know nothing about the issues in any given area, much less the climate issue, how are they to decide to whom to give all of the funds that they hand out? I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars. How do they decide who to give that money to? The answer is this. They go by prestige. They go by political pull. Over time, what you get is an establishment that is designed not to do good science. It's designed to get government money. As Ayn Rand put it, what that ultimately the impact that has on people is they stop caring about truth or falsity, only care about how they can clamor for government funds. It really has a destructive impact on intellectual freedom. because what it sets up is a dynamic in which people no longer care about truth and falsity. They only care about getting funding. Now, ask yourself this. After decades and billions of dollars in government funding going to climate researchers like James Hansen, people like Paul Ehrlich and others, once you get that establishment created, what happens when people start to challenge that establishment? What happens when a company like Exxon comes along and it decides we're going to fund CEI and other groups? That's a direct attack, in a sense, I mean that figuratively, on what government has been doing. So how does the establishment that's been created react? Of course it reacts with the kind of outrage that it's reacting to. It's bread and butter is really being threatened. Politicians are facing the threat that they've been wasting billions in climate in taxpayer funds, that they've been doing the wrong thing. The fact that they are lashing out now and going after the companies in this circumstance, I don't think that's all that surprising. Excuse me. And I think a large part of the reason for that is exactly that government is funding research today that it shouldn't be. All right, let's turn to the next guest now. Walter, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. My next guest is Walter Olson. Walter is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. I have to say, I don't know how you'll take this, Walter, but I'll say one of the best people in D.C. You could take that either as a compliment or as damning by faint praise, because D.C. is not exactly the greatest area.
Tallest building in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Yeah, there you go. But Walter's written on legal topics now for his whole career, a number of really good books. Maybe we can talk about some of those. But Walter, as you know, we're talking about the Exxon, the investigations by the state AGs of Exxon, and now the subpoena to, as you put it in an article recently, our friends at CEI, which is a real threat to freedom of speech. So I'd like to just start off by having you give your perspective on this. And what are the stakes of both the Attorney General investigation and the subpoena to CEI, in your view?
These are very high stakes for intellectual liberty, extending far beyond this particular issue and this particular set of parties, because they announced first New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and then at this point more like 20 Democratic state attorneys general, former Vice President Al Gore, a cheering section of activist groups, intellectuals, very wealthy foundations supporting the effort. They have announced that there should be legal enforcement action taken against those who propagated what they consider to be the wrong views and opinions on global warming. And they are initially going after the Exxon Corporation and its relations, often years in the past, with think tanks and nonprofits of various sorts. But they have explicitly announced that they don't intend to limit it to this, that they intend to investigate Shell and various other companies, and more broadly to take action against what they consider to be their new definition of fraud, which is very different from the way that the law has traditionally defined fraud. And their new definition of fraud is closer to people who've disagreed with them in public argument than it is to selling a can of tomatoes with a label saying that it's spinach, which is more what the law traditionally regards as fraud. And it's menacing. It's menacing even if CEI is completely vindicated, as I believe it will be, in the court process, because the process itself becomes the punishment. The process itself is experienced as harassment. If you are ExxonMobil itself, of course, you can afford the best lawyers because you are one of the world's most productive corporations. If, on the other hand, you are set up as a nonprofit, a special type of institution which is not meant to gather huge amounts of money to pay lawyers, but it's often living from hand to mouth, then the legal fees could sink you by themselves. The threat of legal fees could chill your speech ahead of time. And that, I think, is what so many people are worried about.
Yeah, no, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I worked at IJ for many years, and I've seen this up close. This is a real threat to free speech. Now, you talked about something that I think I've been talking a bit about this during the show, which is the way you put it, I think, is a really good way to put it. So I'm going to adopt that, which is a new definition of fraud, different from the old definition. And no doubt the AGs think that it's the new and better, improved definition of fraud. But let's talk a little bit about that. So I've been talking about the fact that I don't really think that something like what the AGs are accusing the energy companies or fossil fuel companies of could possibly be fraud under any rational definition of fraud for any number of reasons. But I wonder, you talked about the traditional view of fraud versus the new definition. If you could tell our readers a bit about what the traditional definition of fraud is, and then what has happened, both what's different about this new definition and how did we get to this point?
Sure. The law has always recognized, going far back in jurisprudence, that there is the larger universe of statements that are lies or ungrounded, where the person can't show evidence for what they're asserting, that are based on faith or based on a desire to persuade, versus the much, much narrower category of statements that the law is willing to punish as fraud. And this turns up in, for example, politics. And I throw that out because it's worth getting back to whether the people in charge of government could themselves live by the standard that they are prescribing for their adversaries. Politicians campaign for office saying things that we know are untrue or exaggerations, or that give only one side of the story on a complex issue. They tell half-truths. Sometimes they tell untruths. Can politicians be held liable for these untruths? In everyday life, in the in dating, in family relations, people, for a mix of good and bad motives, tell untruths. Sometimes they are ill-motivated untruths, meant to get someone to cooperate in something that they wouldn't cooperate in, like going out on a date if they knew what the truth was. And yet, again, the law does not punish them. And we can talk about why. We can talk about how the judges over the centuries have looked into the abyss of potentially universal punishment based on inevitably selective enforcement, and how much power it would give to prosecutors, and how frequently it could be confused whether or not a statement was true or false. But let's cut to where the judges wound up over the course of the development of common law, which is untruths that lured people into particular kinds of transactions, typically transactions where they gave up something material, such as buying something or agreeing to sell their house. These misrepresentations were part of, often they were part of what you might call theft. And remember that the phrase force and fraud, is one known to all of our listeners. And force and fraud were connected because mere persuasion, even if it was bad for you, even if it was based on faulty premises, was not the same as force. Fraud added the element that you had talked the person into walking off a practical cliff by giving you their property or selling it for less than it was worth, and you had effectively taken it. It was most often a kind of theft by deception. And the law carefully cabined that so that it was an important commercial concept, and people had the confidence that they needed to enter the market and know that you could not be sold an arsenic-laced food product that did not disclose that it was laced with arsenic. And yet, at the same time, most of the rest of life, whether it be in personal relations or efforts to change the public climate of belief on politics, religion, you name it. And I've even talked about, you know, how this could affect religion if taken seriously and consistently, which no one proposes to do. But in all of those other areas, we allowed half-truths and even untruths to simply be met in a marketplace of ideas where the best counter to them was to offer the better arguments, the whole truths can combat half-truths in the marketplace of ideas. Now, I'll point out one case because it's a kind of interesting middle case or intermediate case, as lawyers like to call it, which is a few years ago, Nike, I believe it was, the fashion and shoe company, advertised that it had followed various what were considered socially responsible principles, like we don't buy from sweatshops, I'm simplifying, but that sort of thing. And they were sued on the grounds that, well, you lied about this policy area of how progressive your labor practices were. Now, in traditional law, there would be no case whatsoever there, except for the fact that there were some people out there who might have bought shoes based specifically on that promise. And that's what made it interesting. That's what left the door open to, well, maybe this is like fraud, because someone may actually have laid out money based on the idea that these were produced in certain types of factories that treated their workers very well. So the courts wound up leaving the door partway open to that. But, of course, even if judges could be brought along on that, they were not announcing the proposition that every time a company lies about a public policy issue, every time a company says, yeah, we're overtaxed, but actually you find they've got some deal that lets them off of most of their taxes, that they are somehow committing fraud. You have to, again, proceed as a judge would and look for cases where someone has proved that they were lured into a damaging transaction. And
yeah.
With this, you've got the Attorney General grasping at straws, saying, oh, well, there are people out there who wouldn't have bought gasoline if they would have taken a bicycle instead if Exxon had not. And for most of us, this argument just wouldn't get anywhere at all. It's too close to the, you said that the Democrats would bring us a more prosperous economy and they didn't, therefore you owe me money, which is, all politics, all political life would collapse if you could sue someone for that basis.
Yeah, no,
and,
I was just going to say that's a great way to put it, because if you blur the line, I think, between fraud and free speech, what you end up doing is you put government in charge of what we can say, and you can create a kind of orthodoxy there. It's like having a central scrutinizer, to use Frank Zappa's term, or a central censor who's now gonna look at everything everybody says and decide whether somebody fudged the truth or indeed what the truth is. But I really like the way you put it, that fraud is tantamount to theft by deception. Now, I think you've written a little bit about other areas outside of the context of these investigations of the oil companies in which we're seeing something similar, I think, with the SEC and demanding disclosure from companies. So talk a little bit in closing just about some of the implications that we might see in the law elsewhere.
This is part of a broader trend in which much of the American political establishment has lost its traditional bearings on free speech. It used to be that they would disagree with you, they would regulate you, and yet at some level they realized that they were not so shameless as to suppress your speech. Now you are seeing, not just in this Attorney General investigation, but across many other areas. You mentioned the Securities and Exchange Commission. So let me point to two recent examples of that. One is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has said that she disagrees with the congressional testimony that companies have made saying that particular regulation is going to be burdensome. This is in the investment business because she has evidence that in talking to investors, the companies said, now we can live with it. It's disruptive, but we'll still make a profit. She considers that to be proof that they committed effectively advocacy fraud in telling the Labor Department, the new regulation was too onerous on them. And so she says the SEC should punish them because of it's an investor issue. Likewise, the so-called public advocate in New York, who is an elected official in the New York City government, has written to the Securities and Exchange Commission saying that Sturm Ruger, the handgun manufacturer, sells particularly to police, I believe, committed a securities law fraud violation by not sufficiently getting on board with gun control, basically, not issuing certain sorts of statements about how its guns were terrible and the government should do more to control them. What's happening is that these regulatory complaints getting companies in potentially a lot of trouble and certainly making them pay a ton of money for lawyers are turning into all-purpose revenge for saying things that anger the politicians. These are not shareholders who are complaining. These are not people saying, I bought the stock at the wrong price. These are politicians trying to shut up their opponents.
Yeah, so this is kind of a backdoor version of regulation, but I look at it in many ways. I mean, look, the regulatory state is terrifying enough, but if they are armed with the ability to strong-arm companies through threat of litigation because they said things that politicians disagreed with, I mean, that's a whole new...
You could do 10 shows on this, and let me just throw in one more example because I know you.
Sure.
So, with Obamacare, remember the episodes in which the health insurance companies, which in the worst tradition of go-along-to-get-along capitalists, had cooperated with the Obama administration, figuring that at least there was a role for them to make a profit. And then after the law was on the books, they realized that it wasn't working out and that the numbers were much worse. And they began saying so. They began, as they indeed should, out of obligation to their investors, saying, watch out, we want to raise a red flag that Obamacare is not working out as well in our business. And the Obama administration, and this is one of the most shocking things that it has done in the last 8 years, threatened them with retaliation if they continued to speak up in the business press about their own profits and losses.
Yeah. I remember that, and that was terrifying.
Yeah, just shocking because we have moved beyond here the very dubious stage of saying you're not allowed to say, half-truths or things that we disagree with. They were saying you can't even say obviously true things.
Yeah,
because it's
totally
that's inconvenient.
That's completely crazy. It sounds like there's another book in there for you. But anyway, we're out of time, so let me say thanks very much for being on the show, Walter. And I mean, thanks for the work you do. I've learned a tremendous amount from you over the years. So I really appreciate
you
being on the show. Thanks.
And I'm very glad to be on. Thank you. Bye.
Good. Okay, so we're just about out of time. So I'm going to wrap up. I want to emphasize a point. I didn't get really deeply into the issue of why the legal theories are wrong here. Maybe some of my listeners are saying, well, thank God I didn't want to hear any more legal mumbo jumbo anyway. But take the point that Walter Olson made, which is fraud is a form of theft by deception. What is happening here in this is a debate. And the idea that somehow these companies are defrauding their investors is utterly rubbish. I mean, it's crap. It's totally wrong. As Walter put it, shareholders aren't failing to buy stock in oil companies because the oil companies aren't telling them that they may stop drilling in the future. This is a way for politicians to turn their hopes and aspirations, and really evil hopes and aspirations, by the way, into reality by dragooning companies into towing the line, by threatening them with fraud prosecutions, criminal prosecutions, as though they're the mafia, for taking issue with what future the politicians want to see. It's a really dangerous development. But I don't want to end on a bad note, so I'm going to end on a positive note. And I want to make two points in closing. The first is, if this doesn't convince you that we need to defend free speech, I don't know what could. I mean, this is what I have been focusing on in my career over the last several years, and indeed, heck, practically the last decade, is defending free speech. It is such an important right. I mean, if we lose free speech, it's game over. We don't even get to try to change the the future. So you have to defend free speech. And let me just make one quick point here. Connect this in your own mind, the Exxon investigations, to the Citizens United decision, which is the case that the Supreme Court held allow corporations to spend money, excuse me, on political speech. Imagine what happened. There's a big movement these days to overturn that case and to amend the Constitution to prevent corporations from spending money on speech. Ask yourself, what happens in a circumstance like what we're seeing now if that's the case? They don't even have to sue Exxon anymore. They can just tell them corporations aren't allowed to speak. You're censored. Same thing with CEI. It's a corporation. ARI, we're a corporation. One of the points that Justice Kennedy made in that decision is that corporations offer all kinds of important information and debate just as individuals do. That shouldn't surprise us. They are made up of individuals. So defend free speech. But the point that I really want to end on here is not just that you should defend free speech, but that it is possible to do. We heard from Alex Epstein about the work he does, and I think you could sum up his work as moral courage and taking a moral stance. Watch his video from his Senate testimony. You will see him terrifying a group of senators, in particular Barbara Boxer, by taking a moral stance. They are just not used to that. Excuse me. I'm sorry about this. Maybe it's the amount of talking I'm doing. But anyway, they're not used to that, and it really sets people back. Taking a moral stance is great. Is a great way to disarm your enemies and prop up your allies. I mean, it's really important. I can tell you, having been on the front lines of many fights like this when I worked as a lawyer, it was great to get people writing me emails saying, we really appreciate what you do. We think you're fighting for, you know, goodness and righteousness. It really props up. It helps people in this circumstance. So support CEI no matter what you think of the work they do. I think the work they do is great. But even if you disagree with them, you should support them because they are in this fight. The moment the government launches an investigation like this, the issue is no longer about the merits of the debate. It's all about whether we will have the ability to conduct ourselves and have a debate. Now, I want to say, though, that there's all kinds of things you can do to defend free speech in this circumstance, and these kinds of things matter. And again, I'll point to both what CEI and what Alex did. Let me read just a couple other lines from the letter that CEI wrote to the AG of the Virgin Islands that sent them the subpoena, because it's really just a model of what people need to do. And as I said earlier, this is not the kind of thing you see. It's great that CEI is doing this. So here are a few quotes. The subpoena you served on CEI is a blatant attempt to intimidate and harass an organization for advancing views that you oppose. The focus on us is an effort to punish us for public policy views, chill associations, and silence advocacy. The freedom of belief and expression guaranteed by the Constitution do not yield even to government officials' insistence that some perceived crisis demands urgent action. The niceties of the law be damned. That is what the right to dissent, that is when the right to dissent matters most. This is an organization taking a moral stance and really pushing back. I predict they will be successful, although this is really a horrifying thing to see. But my ultimate point is this: you can make a difference by speaking out. Write letters to congressmen. Express moral outrage about this. Write op-eds if you're able to do that. Write letters to the editor. Just talk to people and say that what is happening here is absolutely wrong, that free speech is imperiled, that indeed the entire future of the nation is imperiled if this kind of thing can happen. So let me leave you on that, I hope, inspiring note. Fight for free speech. You can actually make a difference here. So keep fighting. We'll keep up the good fight on our end. Thanks very, very much for listening to the show today.